Okay, this is continuing with George Whitfield on 19th May 1981. You said that it may well have been Tony Hewish's idea, and I think that's probably right since he worked...
It might have been Tony Hewish. I wouldn't put it higher than that.
He did work on the solar occultations, of course, also.
Right. It might well have occurred to him to see what the moon was doing.
But now, how did you get involved in this?
I think I had suitable equipment.
In what sense?
That I can't remember now.
Was it because you could steer the...
Yes, wait a minute. I had a north-south steerable array. And if I remember rightly, we used the north-south array only and did a total power measurement.
But you had to be able to look in the sky, of course, wherever the occultation was taking place.
The right declination.
Right.
Now, John Blythe couldn't do it with his aerial because you can't do this with an unfilled aerial where you keep moving in steps. You have to have all the elements there at once.
That's right.
And nobody else had a big 38 megahertz aerial.
Right. And you wanted a lot of...
If I was going to do this at 38 megahertz, it had to be my aerial.
Right. And do you remember why you wanted to do it at a low frequency? Was that just because the sources were stronger there? Or?
I think we wanted to do it at a low frequency. Certainly, we wanted to look at the moon occulting something at a low frequency as the best way of seeing if it had an atmosphere.
Ah, yes, because that was one of the main things of interest, right? And
yes.
There'd be more effect.
We were quite surprised when we did the sums and then went and talked to people that nobody really had a good upper limit for the lunar atmosphere.
Right.
And that we'd produced quite a reasonable one.
Now, the stated value was something like less than 10 to the 6th particles per cubic centimeter from the IC443 occultation.
Yes.
And then the following year, a value of about 10 to the 4th, not a limit, was published based on the Crab occultation. And later results, I think, would say that this turned out to be not correct in the sense that the moon does not have... that many electrons per cubic centimeter for an atmosphere. Now, do you remember on what basis you felt that the moon did have this atmosphere? I mean, what?
No, I didn't. This was a sideline. I suspect the calculation was done by Bruce Ellsmore.
I think he was more the person behind it, right? So your role in this was mainly in providing the aerial and assisting with the observations.
And certainly one of the occultations... was a disaster.
In what sense?
In the sense that we got a change in intensity that was obviously ludicrous. There was something wrong with the aerial.
Mm-hmm. Okay, another experiment along this line, so you might call them experiments of opportunity, was when Comet Arend-Roland came in, and you did that with Jan Hergbaum.
Once again, it was a matter of I had the convenient aerial, so I pointed it in the direction that he did the sun, I think.
Right, but there was no positive result.
Nothing significant out of it. An upper limit, I think, but we didn't detect the beast. So wait a moment, what we were trying to do? We were trying to detect radiation from it, I think.
Well, either emission or scattering of other.
Yes.
But I don't think you had any kind of effect at all.
No, we had no effect at all.
Right. And other people...
I remember seeing that comet outside Ken Machin's house, standing outside looking for it, and we couldn't see it. But suddenly we saw it, and it was covering about a quarter of the sky.
Yeah.
We hadn't seen it, it was too big.
Yeah, and probably your eyes weren't dark adapted at first also, yeah. Now, the final... experiment along these lines is, of course, the Sputnik observations, which you have a whole chapter about in your thesis, which is very nice for me to have, because I have various people's descriptions of this period from John Baldwin, for instance. And,
oh, that was great fun.
And that's what everyone says, but I'd be interested in hearing your version of how you heard about it and what you did in those frantic week or two.
Well, It goes something like this. At 9 o'clock in the morning, we regularly had a Saturday morning literature survey. And that particular morning, whose date I'd have to look up, but you doubtless have.
Well, October 4th was the Friday, and then the 5th was Saturday, I think.
Yes. It, somebody came in and said, or something like, the Russians put up a satellite. And great excitement. There was a little bit in the papers or on the news or something that morning. It was radiating at 38 megahertz. It was going beep, beep, beep. Precious little elf. So we thought, let's go and see if we can observe this thing. So we instantly went out to the field lab. Bruce Ellsmore and me, I think. And he retuned my receiver to 40 megahertz, not 38. He retuned my receiver to 40 megahertz.
Right.
Well, I put up a couple of dipoles. Just sort of rigged up somehow. And we coupled them up and watched the pen for an hour and a half. Another piece of information we had was period was 96 minutes or something.
But you had no idea what the phase of it was, so to speak.
But we had no idea what the phase was.
Right.
So after an hour and a half or just over, heard nothing. We sort of mentally said bother and went back and gave it up. But of course we left the thing running. Great thing about a recording system is you can leave it going when you're not there. Well, after lunch, I thought I'd do some thinking about this. So I got hold of the evening paper, which came out at 2 o'clock. And there was a certain amount of information given. The sort of things which were given were the height of the orbit or the period, I forget which. The inclination of the orbit to the equator. And various bits and pieces like who had heard it when.
Right.
And I got hold of the blackboard globe we had in the department.
Yes.
And drew an orbit on it at 65 degrees, I think, was the angle.
Right.
And started to consider how Cambridge would move about under this orbit.
Yes.
And came to a conclusion that there would be about 12 hours during which the orbit would be substantially on the other side of the world and you would get nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be about 12 hours where you would be getting it every hour and a half. And so I went out every hour or so getting the next edition of the paper and getting more information, building up the picture, until I had got the orbit more or less fixed, except that I didn't know whether it was going east about or west about.
Right.
And at that time, I think I rang up a post office tracking station, which had been probably Baldock.
Well, I think it was Tatters. Is it Tatters Field?
May have been. I can't
remember. I think it's mentioned in your thesis here.
If it's mentioned in the thesis, that's the one. Because they had been reported as tracking it during the night. By that time, I knew that during the night it had been passing north of us. And the one missing piece of information had been, was it passing eastwards when it was north or westwards when it was north?
Mm-hmm.
And that they were able to give me. So by the evening of the Saturday, I had an orbit drawn.
It was going eastwards, I would assume.
It was, I think, going eastwards.
Because, of course, it's much easier to launch something to the east.
Yes. I hadn't thought of that one.
Yeah. Well, once again, after 20 years of space science, it's a lot easier than when the first satellite goes up, right?
Yes. It came as a complete surprise. We had no idea that this thing was going up. Anyway, that evening, probably I went out and saw recordings, certainly the next morning. We were up there looking at recordings. Clearly, we had got it. And then we started trying to devise experiments that would track it properly.
Right.
Now, the first thing we had to do was to put up two aerials which were surveyed, so that we knew where they were. The first two aerials had just been stuck up anyhow.
Right.
So, I think I probably did that on the Sunday. By then I knew that there was nothing doing during the middle of the day. And we got that organized. About that time, John Blythe was thinking about the use of the Doppler effect.
Mm-hmm.
That may have been a day or so later. And about that time, we started thinking about how one might analyze these various records. And probably by about the Monday or the Tuesday, probably by the Monday, I developed that hyperbolic technique with the piece of paper lying diagonally across it.
Mm-hmm.
In my thesis.
Right.
For analyzing particular passes.
Now, in these first two or three days, was it virtually everyone in the group doing one thing or another on this, or was it mainly you and Blythe and Elsmore?
I think it would have been us three sort of the first day, but it rapidly grew, I think, to everybody during that first week. I don't know how it first occurred to us with Doppler shift. Possibly from measurements from Baldock, who had, I think, a frequency counter.
Mm-hmm.
Very rare and strange beast in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I think we got figures from them, which suggested that the frequency was changing.
Right.
And once that had been suggested, it occurred to somebody that the rate at which that changed would give you the range.
Mm-hmm.
So then we had to devise a system for measuring it. And that was lovely. Not my work, probably Graham Smith. But it worked something like this. The signal was picked up on a receiver at 40 megahertz. The signal was mixed with a reference signal, also somewhere near 40 megahertz.
Right.
Now, the reference signal, I think, would have been held at exactly 40 megahertz because it was taken out of the oscillator which had a crystal calibrator. And the gentleman sitting there had earphones on and listened to the crystal calibrator and held the local oscillator spot on.
I see.
Now, that's the first operator. What came out now, then, was a low-frequency IF.
Right.
At some audio frequency. This was put onto the X plates of our one oscilloscope.
Yeah.
The Y plates of our one oscilloscope had the output of an audio oscillator, which was adjusted by number two so as to hold the zero Lissajou.
Right.
Now, I may be wrong about Lissajou. It may have been a double beam scope and he had two traces.
But in any case, he zeroed it, so to speak.
He held it at zero frequency. When he got it to zero frequency, he shouted on.
Yeah.
Number three, at that instant, read the frequency of this oscillator.
Mm-hmm.
And number four read the time on the clock. Number four was also the scribe. He wrote down the time when he read it.
Right.
And the chap who had been reading the oscillator called out the frequency.
Right.
And that was written down too.
Okay, so then, and this went on for, a single pass would be for how?
As the satellite came by.
How long would a single pass be, for 5 minutes?
About 5 minutes.
Yeah.
We then had an hour and a half, nearly, in which to plot these, probably 100 or so points, take the slope of the crossover, compute the range from the slope.
Right.
And possibly do a little bit more calculation. Before it came round again, the whole system formed up, and you had another go.
Right.
And this team of four would be doing that all night. There'd probably be another one or two working on the interferometer records all night. And after a day or two, we had the press in as well. So when we weren't actually working, we were talking to the press and talking to the BBC and having television film made of us and what have
you. But now, was it sort of two, did you start going on 12-hour shifts so that you could continually? Oh, no, you said you didn't see it for about 12 hours a day.
That's right. One could have the days off, except one was sending off the press.
And this went on continuously for a week or two?
It went on continuously for the best part of a week. At the end of that week, I got married.
Is that right?
Yes. The following Saturday, the 12th.
Oh, in fact, now this story is coming back to me. But go ahead, you tell it.
Which one?
Well, I think the story was basically that you had to get hauled out of the shack off to your wedding.
Oh, no, I don't think that's not quite true.
That's not quite true.
Not quite true.
Well, that's the way it's grown.
They well have. We also had various other interesting things. There was a meeting of the Royal Astronomical Society, I think on the Friday.
A week afterwards, uh-huh.
Yes, exactly a week after the satellite went up. To which I'm sorry to say I didn't go. Everyone else went. And they tell me that Martin Ryle was being primed with information all the way up. And somehow or other, he put it together and gave a most excellent talk about what we'd been doing.
Mm-hmm.
More or less off the top of his head.
You mean primed by all the different members of the team?
Right. On the things they had been doing.
Now, you didn't go because it was the day before your wedding or something like that?
That's right.
Okay.
And then, of course, the day after, we went off on our honeymoon and left other people tracking the things for next week.
I see. So you did go off on your honeymoon.
Well,
you didn't go back to the shack the next day, huh?
No.
That's good to hear.
I think we still got a photograph we took in the hut at about midnight.
Now that would be nice. That would be nice to see, because I don't think I have any photos except a couple news articles only, but I don't have any good quality photos.
There was also a news article, certainly in the Times.
I have seen a couple of those in the scrapbook that the group used to keep. But
you would be able, I expect, to get originals of those photographs from the papers.
Well, that's true. That's true.
And any others they took.
But in any case, if you can come across any in your collection, that would be nice.
Yes, I think we've got one. I forget who took it, but I think most of us got copies of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you wrote your thesis shortly thereafter. The date on it is March 1958.
Yes.
And are there any other projects that you worked on that I haven't mentioned during your time at Cambridge, almost 5 years?
I did a project on the clustering of radio stars.
Oh, yes.
Which didn't come to anything.
And what was the idea of that?
Well, the idea was to see whether they were clustered. And the technique was to plot them on a suitable projection.
Yes.
And count the number of radio stars of given intensities in equal solid angles.
Right.
and then compare these numbers with the Poisson distribution.
I see.
And there was no significant difference.
And was this based on any particular hypothesis as to the nature of the stars, or just...
No, this was just
purely just to see what was there?
Sniffing tremulously at an infinite series of rat holes.
Okay.
Look at. If there'd been something there, it would have been very interesting.
Right, indeed.
If it wasn't, so it wasn't.
Well, that's still a game that people play.
To
try to understand the nature of things.
And it's a very good game, I think, for research students to play.
Yeah.
Because you learn almost as much of techniques by doing one that doesn't work as by doing one that does.
Right, exactly.
So it's well worth a try.
Where did you go once you had finished your thesis?
Went to RRE at Malvern.
I see. And
I wanted to stay in radio astronomy, but there were no openings. And so RRE had a small radio astronomy group. They didn't want me.
And so you went to another part of the...
Or perhaps the organization didn't want me to do it.
Right. So you went into what field then?
I went into airborne radar.
I see. But now you say there were no openings. Was that including, were you interested in going overseas even?
I didn't try. I wasn't terribly interested in going overseas.
Yeah.
But I didn't get the impression that there were openings overseas either.
Well, you probably knew it better then than I do now, but it would seem to me that someone coming out of the Cambridge group with the Ray Wader Astronomy was going in those days probably could have... I've gotten a job either in Holland or Australia or the States.
Yes.
But of course...
Now, who did it? Robin Conway went to Holland back then.
That's right. Yeah. But in any case, if you're not interested in going overseas, then that takes care of that.
Well, I don't know. Perhaps I was a bit thick in the mud. But...
Did you ever think about trying to go back to radio astronomy after you'd been out for a year or two or three?
No, I didn't. One gets interested in other things.
Right, right. Well, let me ask a couple general questions in closing. First of all, the Cambridge group obviously has been one of the most successful in radio astronomy, especially during this period. To what would you ascribe that success?
Oh, dear. I think, first of all, it was a very good group to work in. In the way one describes a ship as a happy ship.
Right.
We all work together. Anybody would do anything. I mean, when it came to digging the holes to pour the concrete for holding my aerials up originally,
mm-hmm.
I think we all dug holes.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us poured concrete.
Right.
And that includes Graham and Tony and Martin.
So you think that it may have been namely that the officers on the ship were willing to...
Well, that's a part of it. The second part, undoubtedly, is that I think Martin particularly was brilliant. So that there was some very good scientific direction.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back, I didn't get the impression that Tony Hewish was terribly good. But I think, looking back, he was a lot better than I saw from the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, we had some very good people. Graham was very good. And some good research students. So it was a good team.
Right.
But I think the leadership was extremely good.
Right.
Whereas we got the impression that Manchester, for example, was much less happy.
In terms of... fights between different groups and...
I don't know. I don't know the details.
Right. What did you look upon as the people that were producing the most reliable results other than Cambridge?
Oh, wait a minute. The other point, we had a very good head of the radio group in James Ratcliffe.
In what sense was he good?
In the sense that he ran a very good group. I don't think he was terribly good scientifically. But he was an excellent organizer, and as much as anything, he knew when to leave people alone.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed to be able to raise the necessary money, And when he did come and talk to you about something, he would spend long enough and listen clearly enough to get a good grasp of it and then ask you the one question you hadn't thought of.
Mm-hmm.
So that if he wasn't terribly original himself, he was a great help to those who were.
Right. Well, many people play that role of sort of a provocateur.
Yes. And I think one could do a lot worse in a group than have somebody like Ratcliffe heading it and somebody like Martin Rowell providing the science.
Indeed. Well, in fact, it has been said by others, in fact, Ken Machen was one of them, that Ratcliffe played an important role in terms of relieving Martin Rowell of much of this administrative duty.
I think that's true. Has Ken Machen told you about the time they were stopped by the police, shall we say, rejoicing down the middle of the road?
No. Please tell me that one. I haven't heard that one.
And Martin Rowell and a couple of others. Policeman inquired what they were doing and said, "Oh, we're celebrating his FRS."
Uh-huh.
And it was true.
Right, but that didn't mean too much to the policeman.
So he was absurdly young for the...
Right.
Sorry.
Did that go over with the policeman, though?
I can't remember.
maybe for a Cambridge policeman.
I think for a Cambridge policeman it would have.
He might know, yeah.
I think, yes, my wife says she thinks he thought they were undergraduates.
Oh, even that young, I see.
Yes. Certainly I heard tell of the chap who wandered into the group and was telling some strange, lanky undergraduate fellow what he was proposing to get away with.
Yes.
Turned out to be Martin, and he told him in no uncertain terms that he wasn't going to do that.
This chap was an undergraduate himself, you mean?
I think so.
Yeah, right. Okay, well...
So that was one side of things. I think that's why we were so good.
Yeah. No, there's... I mean, many people have testified to that real esprit decor of the group. That just about covers what I wanted to cover. Is there any other points you'd like to make or things you think I've missed?
Yes. They've shown you round the attic we used to work in, have they?
Well, I visited the group before they moved out. In 73 was the first time I visited here, so...
Yes.
So I did see the old setup, yes. That, in fact, was where the Rutherford thing was also, wasn't it? The Rutherford Lab.
Yes.
I think it also was up there.
And the old lecture rooms.
Yes.
And we were sort of right next door to the MRC unit.
Right.
Perutz & Co.
No, it was a very homey sort of thing there, certainly relative. You've probably been out to the new site, which is much more of the, you know, the large...
Yes. I was just about leaving about the time we moved out to Lord's Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's see, Lord's Bridge was building while the Sputniks were going up.
That's right. Lord's Bridge was officially opened, I think, in early 57.
Yes, but we were building the aerial earlier than that.
Right.
Did they tell you the aerial blew down?
Yes, the famous storm. Yes, I have heard about that one.
When Sputnik 2 was up, it blew down the aerials we were observing Sputnik 2 on.
But also it blew down part of the 4C aerial.
And it blew down part of the 4C aerial.
Right.
And the press came to see us about Sputnik 2, and they drove straight past the 4C aerial, and there it was all lying flat on the ground. They asked us about this strange aerial out at on the outskirts of Cambridge, and we said, "Oh, yes. That's our new aerial under construction." And not one of them twigged
right.
That it had blown down. We didn't want to give it away.
Just because it would not look not look good, you mean?
It wouldn't look good.
No. Yeah, right. Amazing.
I don't think in retrospect it would have mattered.
Yeah. But, I mean, why, if they're not going to discover it for themselves, then why tell them, yeah?
That's right. Yes. Keeping our end up or something.
Right.
What else were we doing? Oh, about the early days of the Sputnik, I think there was a time when we were the only people in the country who knew where the Sputnik was.
Mm-hmm.
And we were giving predictions to various people.
I mean, not even the military really knew what was going on?
I think it was tracked by radar by one or two people, but nothing was published. And certainly we were giving predictions to the Cambridge astronomers, so they could photograph it.
Right, right.
Sad tale there, they put a theodolite on it and took the time, then waited for it to get light so they could calibrate it.
Yes.
Before it got light, somebody kicked the leg of the theodolite. I forget which Sputnik that was. It might have been number two.
Actually, that's a rather nice turn of events that you were supplying more accurate positions to the optical astronomers.
Well, they weren't more accurate positions, but they were. We were telling them where to look.
Well, that's what I mean. But I mean, previously, they had more accurate positions, and they were griping to the radio astronomers about you can't tell us where to look accurately enough. And so it's a rather turn of the tables there.
Well, it was still much the same, actually. As soon as they saw it, they would have much better position than us.
Oh, sure, sure.
So it was just like the radio stars.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. This has been just the kind of information I like. Yes, now, which groups, other than Cambridge, did you find had the most reliable data, in your opinion, at that time?
The Dutch group. Can't put names to them instantly.
Well, Oort and Westerhout and van der Holst.
That's right. And, now, the NRL lab.
Yes, in Washington.
Good high frequency work.
Right. Which was useful for your spectral work, of course.
My spectra, because nobody else was doing much up there.
Right.
And, the other major contributor from our point of view was the Australian group.
Right.
Bolton and, again, names are beginning to disappear.
Well, Mills, of course.
That's right, Mills and his cross.
But now, when the disagreement began to develop between the Mills survey and the 2C survey, did this then mean that you had less faith in all of the radio physics measurements, or was it only basically that survey?
I think different people had different opinions on this one.
What was your opinion?
I'm trying to recall precisely what the disagreement was. It was mainly a matter of what's the density of radio stars at great distances.
Right.
And I think it was much more a matter of interpretation of, should we say, the difficult, scraggy ends of readings.
Yes.
And I don't think it was an important argument.
Well, but I think it was in terms of the development of the field. I mean, there was just a fundamental difference between the maps of the areas which overlapped. And one just didn't know who to believe if you were, a cosmologist trying to understand these counts of sources and so forth.
Oh, well, I think I've either missed it or forgotten it.
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a major thing with you then.
But certainly my impression by the time I was leaving was the 2C and then the 3C surveys were arguing, for the Big Bang.
Yes.
For the situation at great distances being different from the situation locally.
Oh, yes. That was the whole push of Ryle and the rest of the group.
On the basis that the statistics went wrong, not that you could plot the actual stars.
That's right. It was the so-called P of D analysis.
That's right.
Developed by Scheuer.
And this didn't depend on whether the stars we got agreed with the stars anybody else got.
Right.
Because one was looking at assorted sums of little stars.
Right.
And, of course, by the time one got down to the low levels, they weren't individual stars anyway.
But now, did you have faith in that analysis?
Yes.
And do you remember if you had any opinion as to why the Mills results were so different from the Cambridge results?
No, I don't remember if I did.
Of course,
he was using a fundamentally different technique.
Right, but of course your antenna had a close analogy in the Mills cross, so you must have thought somewhat about the nature of the advantages and disadvantages of the Mills cross versus your interferometer.
Well, the interferometer has great advantages if you're looking for point sources. Because it's got very high resolution one way.
Right.
And all the large background radiation just disappears.
Right. But in terms of reliability of radio source surveys, do you remember if you had an opinion at that time of
No, I don't.
Who was most likely to have gone wrong, or how to reconcile the two together? Or?
I think I would have trusted an interferometer better for point sources.
But of course, that was part of the debate, was what fraction of sources are really point, and which, and it was no doubt that Mills had more extended sources.
Oh, yes.
But it wasn't clear whether they were really blends of different sources, and, well, the debate went on for many years.
Yes, and really, I suspect it needed higher resolution surveys to clear it up.
Right, and not going so deep with the survey that you had.
Not trying to push the surveys further than they were, than was really justified.
Right, right.
Because we didn't leave at all, Krauss and Co.
Ah, yes.
I don't know what became of them.
Well, Krauss continued right through the 60s and 70s, but indeed I remember one thing that, for instance, he claimed a detection of that same comet, Arend-Roland, and also had variable radiation coming from Venus, similar to what came from Jupiter, and this turned out to be side lobe problems of the Sun.
Yes.
So I think you're right there, that there were many unreliable results coming from.
The other interesting thing was that when people started doing measurements of intensity, one found that, well, I won't say anyone one looked at, but one got the impression that their first measurements weren't very good and they got better for no apparent reason. The chap I'm thinking of was Wells.
Ah, yes.
His early measurements scattered all over my curves. And as the years rolled by, his measurements sort of settled down.
But did you?
Fitted the curves which were, if you like, drawn from everybody else's.
But did you find this phenomenon with several different workers, are you saying?
I don't remember finding it with others, but I wouldn't be. No, I can't remember finding it with anybody else. But it struck me as a sensible and likely thing to happen.
Mm-hmm. Just learning through experience.
Okay, that's the end of the interview with George Whitfield on 19 May 1981.